You're listening to the 28th episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. It's the 17th of May at 5.02 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Communist-speaking Musqueam people. So, Akil, how have you been? You went on the grouse grind today. How was it?
I've been good. I was unwell about a week ago, so got back from that and didn't know if I was going to be able to do the grind today.
What did you have?
Just general cold symptoms. You know, something's in the air. It's change is in the air. I definitely caught the change bug. but I was still trying to go to work, you know, masks on and all that. So that was particularly unpleasant time. But after getting over that, and this morning I told my friend that we would do the grass grind. He texted me, he said, "Are you feeling okay?" I was like, "Yeah, 100%, of course." And he said, "It's going to be raining." I'm like, "Yeah, of course. I'm in Vancouver, right? Of course, a little bit of rain never scared any of us." So we went out there. We ended up doing the BCMC instead of the grouse grind, and it was fantastic. You know how when you're doing it in the rain under the cover of the canopy, it's just misty and it's really nice.
You never really get warm.
You really never really get too warm. It was beautiful. Yeah, fantastic. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Life's been a bit chaotic, but things are looking good. So one thing I've been wondering, Akil, is when are you going to buy a house?
Are you a realtor?
No, you do all this grinding, you're working so hard, and you're doing this stuff. Like, when is the Sigma grind set actually going to pay off for you?
Oh, sorry, I thought the ad break had started earlier than I expected. I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing in the next little bit. So that's why I haven't bought a house. That you know, setting aside the fact that you need a ridiculous down payment to even get into the housing market, even if it would make sense for me to pay whatever premium I would have to pay over my rent in order to buy a house, because, you know, I'm building equity, I'm living the Canadian dream, I'm gonna live as people did in the 70s, right? Like, you're gonna retire, it's gonna be amazing, I have a house. But it just doesn't make sense, because your down payment needs to be like $150,000-$200,000, which would be like all of my savings and then some.
Yeah, I don't think you're grinding hard enough. So anyway, Akil doesn't seem to have a good answer as to why he doesn't own a house. So joining us in studio, we have the proprietor of the Substack, morehousing.ca, Russell Vong, who can maybe help us answer this pondery and many others. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so to kick things off, let's just get to know, you know, a bit more about you. So you're the chair of the Liberal Party Riding Association Vancouver Kingsway, but you're speaking in your personal capacity today. But could you start off by describing what led you to get involved in politics and public policy and advocating for housing?
I guess I was going to just launch into a description of like what I think the problem is with housing in Vancouver. Do you mind if I just launch straight into that? Or do you want the biographical?
Just a little bit of bio. But the next question will be.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I grew up here. I like Canada. And
good, because we were going to ask it. We were just going to give you a gotcha at some point. Like, do you like Canada?
Are you a separatist? Exactly. Are you going to vote to leave?
I guess I feel like, you know, hearing stories from my parents, you know, it often feels like we maybe take our security and our prosperity for granted. Mm. And in particular, what led me to join the Liberal Party, as opposed to just, you know, supporting them and voting for them, was back in the mid-90s, the leader of the Conservative opposition at the time, Stockwell Day, I heard, oh, he doesn't believe in evolution. He thinks the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And yeah, my reaction on hearing that was like, what the hell? Like, I thought that was just like crazy American politicians who believe that kind of stuff. So that's what made me think, oh, okay, I shouldn't just like vote for this party. I should actually like try to get involved. And then, I just sort of went from there.
Yeah, so now you can give us the rundown. So why can't a Kill afford a house in Vancouver? What's the situation?
And for our listeners, I'm making a very making a huge like frowny face as Russell explains why. Yeah.
No, I mean, I guess besides like, okay, how did I get into politics in general? I guess the question of like, how did I get into housing in particular? I'm part of like a local pro-housing crowd, and often we'll, you know, we have a lot of discussion online, but then we'll meet up in person and we'll often go around and ask, well, how did you get radicalized?
Yeah.
And so for me, the answer was I watched a public hearing for like a 6-story apartment building. And I couldn't believe like how broken the process was. And my reaction was like, why hasn't anybody fixed this? So, the short version is like housing here is incredibly scarce and expensive because we have lots of jobs and not enough housing. Like people move where the jobs are. So the result is younger people are being crushed and driven out because the cost of housing is so high. And this is bad even for older homeowners. It's like, where are our kids going to live? How is the healthcare system going to work when hospitals can't find nurses?
And also, you know, for older homeowners, something that gets missed is it might not make sense for you to downsize. If you feel like, oh, I need to leave this house for my children because they're not going to be able to afford a home in this market. So yeah. If I sell this and I go buy something smaller, and it doesn't really help them at all.
Right. So, yeah, I always try to emphasize, like, why people should care, you know, from their own self-interest, right? Like if you're insulated from the market because you own a place, you should still care because, you know, when you live in a city, it's like a large-scale system of cooperation, right? Like you need the healthcare system. We all depend on it. So the thing about housing is this is
Sorry, do you want to move the mic a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to maintain eye contact here. Yeah. So the thing is, this is a fixable problem. We have people who want to live and work here. We have other people who want to build housing for them. The problem is we don't let them. So like, as I saw in this public hearing process, there was a recent report from an expert panel led by Joy McPhail, which to paraphrase, said the issue is we regulate new housing like it's a nuclear power plant and we tax it like it's a gold mine. And then when COVID hit 5 years ago, there was a sudden massive surge in people working from home, so needing more space, and willing to move. So it's like the housing shortage spilled over from Metro Vancouver, like everywhere. The interior, Vancouver Island, into Alberta. Something similar happened from the GTA. So it's basically now like not just a problem localized to Metro Vancouver and the GTA. It's like across the entire country. Our pre-COVID housing stock no longer lines up with where people want to live and work. So we need to build more housing everywhere, not just in the big cities. So to fix this, we need to push municipalities to make it legal by right to like build the next level up. So to add more density, to make better use of the scarce land that we have. So multiplexes, for example, like more than a duplex, like a triplex, quadplex, small apartment buildings everywhere would be great. High rises near rapid transit and city centers. And we also need to reduce costs. So for example, the taxing like a gold mine. So that costs act like a floor on prices and rents. So if we add more and more costs in the form of development charges, we're basically pushing up prices to a point where nobody can afford to buy them, which is how you end up with this paradoxical situation we need more housing, but like there's all these unsold condos because the prices are too high. So then...
Just to pause there for a second.
Yeah.
So what are development charges?
Basically, I'm trying to find a neutral way to phrase this.
You don't have to be neutral.
Yeah.
But just like what like for a random person on the street who's not as clued into this topic, like how would you, you know, break it down for them?
Basically, by default, apartment buildings are illegal almost everywhere in the city of Vancouver. If you want to build an apartment building, you know, even someplace where it makes sense, so say across the Burrard Bridge from downtown, there's a bunch of single-family houses, and you think, oh, you know, I want to build an apartment building, you have to go to City Hall and beg. You know, please change the law for this specific parcel of land so I can build an apartment building there. And as part of that, the city basically says, okay, by doing this, you know, the land value is discounted because it's illegal to build an apartment building. If we make it legal to build an apartment building, that will raise the value of the land. We want to take 80% of that increase in land value. It's supposedly voluntary, but the city of Vancouver collected $2.5 billion in these community amenity contributions over the 10 years from 2011 to 2020. So about $250 million a year, which is about 1/6 of the city's operating budget, just in terms of scale. So that's, how would I describe it? I don't want to say it's a scam, but it is a method that cities can use and have been using to try to keep property taxes low, because people hate it. Voters hate it when the property taxes go up. So instead, the city is kind of taxing this very narrow base of new housing. The problem is this is a very leaky bucket. Again, because you're pushing up prices and rents for new housing, you are also pushing up prices and rents for existing housing. Just like during COVID when there was a shortage of new cars, used cars also became very scarce and expensive. But the additional revenue from that rent on existing housing doesn't go to the city. It goes to private landlords. And so the city's getting some money, but then there's all this other money which renters are having to pay, which doesn't go to the city. It's just like makes landlords richer, right? So yeah, it's kind of a terrible way of funding the city's needs.
So it's the cost. So, you know, it's the cost of housing, of building. So it's even worse. You know, I think we were discussing this earlier. It's even worse than what you would do. It's like for the mine metaphor, it's like before anyone's even built the mine, you're taxing them so heavily that they're de-incentivized to even build a mine.
That might be taking the metaphor a lot, you know, sort of
because
further than I'm
because even if it
thinking.
Was a gold mine, you yes. would do something similar to property taxes. Once the mine is ready, then you would charge the taxes, right? You wouldn't, like, this is even worse in some ways because you're taxing it, preventing the development from happening.
I guess I would say municipal politicians think of it more like, it's like a black box that produces money. Like, yeah. it's kind of hard to tell, like, well, how much money can we take out whenever there's this project being proposed? Yeah. So they rely on consultants to do the calculations. Yeah. But I think politicians are always very puzzled when the calculations come back and they say, well, there's not as much money as there was like a couple of years ago. It's actually shrinking. And they're like, how is this possible? Prices and rents have gone up so much. So the answer is that the value of that discount, which is being removed, depends on both what's happening with prices and rents, but also what's happening with construction costs. It's the difference between those. And then, obviously, because interest rates have risen, how much people are actually able to pay is also down. So yeah, people think of it as like this pot of gold that's kind of bottomless and let's take as much money out as we can. But yeah, it's actually shrinking.
So,
So there was an interview by the new federal housing minister.
Yes.
Where he was. We'll take a listen to it, and then we'll have your reaction to it. So this is Gregor Robertson talking to the press.
Mr. Robertson, housing prices in Vancouver went up while you were mayor. I want to ask you, why do you feel like you have the skills necessary to do this when you saw 179% increase in Vancouver housing prices?
Yeah, we've seen increases like that across Canada over the past decade. Certainly since my time as mayor, we've seen a lot more movement here in Ottawa, and we've got great programs starting to work now. Housing Accelerator Program is partnering with cities to deliver. I'm here to leverage my history as a mayor. I know what works on the ground. I wasn't getting the help I needed from the federal government when I was mayor, or the provincial government of all stripes. We need, as a government in Ottawa, to be delivering and partnering with cities and provinces all together. And making sure we're building enough supply and that the federal government is focused on affordable housing and delivering that. Now, I think that we need to deliver more supply, make sure the market is stable. It's a huge part of our economy. We need to be delivering more affordable housing. The government of Canada has not been building affordable housing since the 90s. and we've created a huge shortage across Canada. That's where the big need is right now, and I'm very encouraged that the Prime Minister and our commitment right now in government is the double construction and focus on the affordable side.
Right. So, Russell, what he said there that I want to focus on is him saying that he doesn't want housing prices to come down, but he does want affordable housing. So, what are your thoughts on that?
So, I would say politicians always seem to overestimate how much voters fear the prospect of house prices going down. I guess, you know, I ran for city council, so I guess I'm a politician. I would say, yeah, my goal in housing activism is actually to get home prices to fall. And I think people don't actually, they're not afraid of it. It's not really a political factor. Reason number one is people don't believe it will ever happen. You know, why would you be afraid of something that you don't think will ever happen? But a more subtle point is that there's no reason for apartments in Vancouver to be so scarce and expensive. Like, we can just build a lot more apartments. Like, we don't have to invent some crazy new technology. Elevators exist, right? But land in Vancouver is scarce. Like, it's limited by the ocean and by the mountains. If you stand in downtown Vancouver and you draw a 25-kilometer circle around it, less than 40% of that is actually buildable land. So we're not going to make any more land. So if you are like a longtime homeowner who owns a detached house, a lot of the value, or if your house is older, you know, almost all the value is going to be in the value of the land. And so you can, it's actually kind of win-win. If we allow more density, we should be able to make apartments cheaper for like first-time homebuyers. If you wanted to buy an apartment, or just if you wanted to, you know, if you're renting an apartment, there's a lot more of them, that should bring down rents. But it should not cause somebody who owns a detached house to lose, because the value of the land should keep its value or even go up, because you can redevelop it for a multiplex or even build a small apartment building. I think I like the way David Eby put it when somebody asked him this like a year ago, was like, you know, prices will probably come down, but it should be kind of like a soft landing. And there are, with more density allowed, landowners, like people who own detached houses, should be able to like to see the value of their land maybe even increase if they redevelop it.
For sure. There's a lot of talk of the housing being the third rail of Canadian politics, and, you know, like you just said, maybe they're not really that afraid of the housing prices coming down, and maybe the issue is to incentivize them the right way to say that, well, you might actually see the benefit of land, of the actual real value of the land, as opposed to what it is right now. Do you really see that it is achievable to allow a much broader entry into the housing market without housing prices actually coming down?
Yes. So in fact, we have some evidence from Auckland, New Zealand, which was suffering from a severe shortage of housing. They had some unification of their municipal governments, and they introduced a broad land use reform and upzoning back in 2016. And so, yeah, within 4 or 5 years, you could see like real rents compared to people's incomes were actually declining. And by comparing it to like the baseline of what was happening in other cities in New Zealand, you could see this divergence within 4 or 5 years where there's downward pressure on prices and rents. But yeah, they could also like look pretty carefully at what was happening with land values. And they saw that land values for the upzone land, did keep their value.
For sure. So, the cornerstone, I think this federal election had a lot to do with housing. There's a big, big conversation around that.
Yep.
And the new Liberal government has a plan. Prime Minister Carney has a plan to create a Crown Corporation, build Canada Homes to build new housing. What are your thoughts on the plan?
I would like definitely to see the details. I think the idea of using federally owned land and having a federal agency to build housing on it is definitely very promising. I would say the federal government should really be taking a close look at what the provincial government in BC has been doing, because they have been extremely active in introducing a lot of programs to, you know, kind of run through BC housing to, for example, make home ownership more attainable by making housing available like at a 40% discount, I believe, with that was with the Heatherlands.
Yes.
So building a bunch of apartments, the provincial government provides funding, and by lowering the price, you know, and there's constraints, like if you buy at the 40% discount, you also have to sell it at the 40% discount at some point in the future. Yeah, it just makes it available to a lot more people. Whereas if they were just trying to sell it at, you know,
at market,
whatever the current rate is, like, again, it's just too high. There's like very few people who can afford to buy it. So then the project would go very, very slowly as they, you know, they build some apartments, they try to sell them, they try to build more, they try to sell them. So having the provincial government come in and say, okay, well, here's the funding and you can sell them at a much lower rate. They should be able to sell them much faster and build the whole thing much faster. So I think models like that are definitely something that the federal government should be looking closely at.
So three key functions of the plan are building affordable housing at scale, including on public land, catalyzing a new housing industry, and of course I need to see details on what that second point means, and providing financing to affordable home builders, which I assume is kind of along the lines of what you were saying, right? Is on the other foot where you're saying that if you're going to be building affordable homes, then we will give you extend credit to you.
Correct. And on the second point, I think I've heard some things about what that means. So there's the way we build is often kind of like, you know, you take everything, you take all the materials out to the site and you put it all together and it's you're at the kind of at the mercy of the elements. And so there's this approach of using prefabrication. Like you set up a factory somewhere, you build like panels, and then you take the complete panels out to the site and you kind of put them together more like Lego. So there are some constraints there, but the idea is that if we're able to make that work successfully, we should be able to improve productivity. In other words, require less expensive labor to like assemble houses. Therefore, we should be able to do it faster and cheaper.
And scale it, yeah.
Yes. Of course, there have been a lot of efforts over the years to do this. It is used quite extensively in Europe. But I guess I would say the key constraints here are economies of scale. Like it only makes sense to do this if you have enough of a volume of revenue. Like you need to have a steady stream of people buying this stuff. Otherwise, the fixed costs of setting up the factory and having the assembly lines to produce this don't make any sense. The other constraint here is transport costs. So there have been some prefab efforts which involve assembling like an entire apartment. But you can imagine, like if you're putting one of these on the back of a truck, it's, you know, the further away you get, the higher your transport costs are. And so the key thing is what scale makes sense in terms of making sure there's enough volume within kind of like a circle around your factory. But again, the federal government, assuming that we have something that makes sense in terms of economies of scale and in terms of like being close enough to where there's demand, the federal government can help by kind of smoothing out demand. There's a tendency for, you know, kind of booms and busts, which makes it hard to make long-term investments. If the federal government can say, well, we definitely want to build a lot more housing, we will give you guaranteed orders if you can supply this at this price. That's the kind of thing that would help.
It's a good thing that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have lots of land near urban centers in this country that can be used for this. And we don't even have to go the Singapore road of reclaiming land. I've been told on good authority that we have lots of land near the urban centers. So, kind of going back a little bit to what you said about the municipal government and the process before, it's a quote, I think, from one of your Substack articles. It's easier to elect a pope than to approve a small apartment building in the city of Vancouver.
Yes.
So why do you think that is? You said part of it was just on the cost side, right? That it becomes prohibitively expensive to build. What other parts of the approval process are painstaking to deal with.
Yeah, no, it's actually nothing to do with cost. It's just purely trying to get to a yes, like getting someone, getting city council to say, yes, you can go ahead and build this. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why people are hesitant about changes to their neighborhood. So to cite some of them, I would say one of them is small C conservatism. You know, people in Vancouver like their neighborhood the way it is. That's why they live there. And so if you're in a single family neighborhood and somebody says, well, you know, I'd like to build a 6-story apartment building on this block. People often, I think of it a little bit like Jaws, you know, the movie Jaws. Back then they didn't have good special effects. And so what they did was they just sort of, you know, they would show the fin or something like that and the scary music and rely on your imagination
to fill in the details.
So similarly, before something's been built is when you have the sort of maximum level of fear. And so, yeah, listening to public hearings, people will often bring up scenarios which to other people might seem far-fetched. Like there was a school in Cole Harbor, which would include some housing above it, and people came out to oppose the school, and they said, you know, having a small children and a marina next to each other is like a recipe for disaster, like the children might fall into the water. One is small C conservatism and sort of fear of the unknown of changes. A second one, I guess I would say, is maybe indifference. So for somebody who has a home and, you know, they're focused on their own lives and work, saving and so on. I've heard from a lot of older people like, oh yeah, housing in Vancouver has always been expensive. I had to sacrifice. And why do these young people drink so many lattes and eat all this avocado
toast? Not grinding hard enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what you said at the beginning, Arman. So there's this kind of, you know, people might not care that much. A third reason I would say is kind of a post-materialist anti-growth kind of attitude, which has been fairly, you know, there's been a sort of strong strand of thought since I would say the 70s. Like, you know, why does Vancouver have to keep growing? Why can't it just kind of stay the way it is? Why do we need apartment buildings? And the answer, I think, is that, so my friend Harmon Moon describes it as city of Vancouver is a little bit like a bonsai tree, right? Like it's lovely, but it's much too small. And so the result is, yeah, for younger people and for homeowners for renters, for anyone who's lower income, yeah, it's really, really terrible. I guess, yeah, in a situation where you have housing scarcity because you haven't allowed the city to grow, housing is all connected, right? It's like you can think of housing like a ladder where, you know, the housing near the top is the most expensive and the housing near the bottom is kind of like terrible. When you don't have enough housing, like when you kind of block new housing or you delay new housing, the people who would have lived in that new housing don't disappear. It's like they will move down the ladder and find somewhere else to live. And so you get this kind of trickle-down eviction effect, and you get this terrible pressure on people near the bottom of the housing ladder. So they end up like crowding into substandard housing or, you know, moving away. Or worst of all, they end up homeless. So I think people don't necessarily realize this, that even if all of the buildings remain exactly the same, again, because we always have people moving here to take jobs, when you don't have enough housing, it's like the cost of housing, prices and rents, act like a filter. And that filter, that barrier, has been getting higher and higher. So the buildings remain the same, but the people who are living in the city basically have to become richer and richer. Or the people who aren't rich are crowded into like worse and worse housing conditions. So that's kind of a third thing, is this sort of kind of attitude, like why do we need to grow, not realizing the terrible effects it has. And then a fourth I would describe is just this kind of anti-capitalist sentiment. The idea that, oh, these people are making millions of dollars. It must be because they're ripping other people off. And so...
And this is the developers.
The developers, yeah. Yeah, as I said earlier, I think of it as, you know, people want to live and work here. Other people want to build housing for them. So to me, it's kind of like win-win, right?
It's like let the market do its thing.
I guess I wouldn't describe it as the market. I would just describe it literally as people want to build housing because other people need a place to live and are willing to pay for it. So in some sense, the developer is a little bit like a middleman. Like, you can think of, there's co-housing projects where the people who will live in the building act as their own developer, but they run into exactly the same barriers as for-profit developers do. Nonprofit housing, also runs into these barriers. So, yeah, I would say a common thing, though, is at these public hearings is, there is kind of this suspicion, distrust, this idea that, yeah, you've got this corporation that wants to build this housing. This is a bad thing. And so, yeah, my view is like, okay, we need housing. Like, housing is a good thing, not a bad thing. And so I always find it maddening when there's this kind of political pressure to make buildings smaller, to remove housing. To me, this makes no sense at all.
Yeah, I just wanted to, there was a moment you were talking about the public hearings. And
yes.
I just want to echo that. There was an experience I had that was also very traumatizing in this way when they were trying to build a basketball court near my parents' place, which was right next to a school.
Yeah.
And there was a public hearing. The basketball court was going to be built by the university. They were going to pay for it. So the UNA wasn't even going to have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And in the public hearing, there were only two people speaking in favor of the basketball court who probably would never play that. It was me and my sister.
Yes.
The other 38 people were all elderly people or different ages, but largely elderly people who were against it. And the arguments they wielded were amazing. One of them was talking about how this would lead to crime and it would make the neighborhood less safe for women. And it would also talk about how somebody else was talking about how, and this was, an elderly white gentleman talking about how this violated the spirit of reconciliation with First Nations by building a basketball court here. And we were like messing with their land. But it's like, it's Vancouver School Board property. So it was really, quite extraordinary. It really encapsulate what you're describing, that these public hearings are completely divorced from reality. Like, if you took a random sample of 40 people in that neighborhood, they would have been, basketball court sounds great. Like, they probably have kids who go to the school. Even if they don't, they're like, that'll make our neighborhood nicer. It's fun to have, when you're walking around and you see people playing basketball, it creates a fun vibe. I don't play basketball, but I was there on that call, asking. I was thinking, no, this is a good thing to do. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that because,
right. Exactly. There's kind of a selection effect where the people who are most fearful and most opposed to whatever change, whether it's basketball court or a six-story apartment building, are the ones who are most motivated to be there. So, I guess I should say I'm involved with the local pro-housing crowd. And one thing we try to do is to counterbalance that sort of natural opposition by just showing up and just to try to remind city council that, we desperately need more housing. So, I'm older myself, but there's, a lot of younger people and renters who are involved in this. So, and anyone who wants to get involved, just go to morehousing.ca or send me an email or something like that, and we'll get you connected.
All right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, the Armand and Akil Show. We're just going to take a quick ad break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Russell Fong on housing.
Hearing helps me build strong budgeting and management skills, all while contributing to my group's sustainability. Ensuring the financial health of the Scouts group gives me a sense of pride knowing I'm helping create opportunities for Scouts to grow.
Take our online quiz and find your perfect volunteer role. Adventure awaits. Join us at scouts.ca/volunteer. Every adventure begins with a spark of possibility, and Scouts Canada volunteers are the ones who bring it to life. Whether it's guiding a hike, teaching new skills, or planning the next big adventure, they create opportunities for youth to grow, connect, and thrive. Volunteering is about more than activities. It's about courage, connection, and unforgettable memories. Whatever your passion, there's a role for you at Scouts Canada. Adventure awaits. Take our online quiz and find your perfect role at scouts.ca/volunteer.
Crafting with the Scouts is not only fun, but helps me build problem-solving skills. This role allows me to bring my creativity, my ideas to life, and every project is an opportunity for me to learn something new.
Take our online quiz and find your perfect volunteer role. Adventure awaits. Join us at scouts.ca/volunteer.
I love being the one who fosters inclusion and community spirit, and in return, I get to expand my own network and friendships. And it's all for the benefit of the kids.
Take our online quiz and find your perfect volunteer role. Adventure awaits. Join us at scouts.ca/volunteer.
This is Alex Runyons. My new album, Above the Clouds and On the Ground, encompasses everything I love the most about making music. As a singer-songwriter, I am passionate about digging into the experiences of life and creating something with intention, meaning, and growth. While this album takes its inspiration from my own transformational experiences as of late, it's also for you. Life is hard. Hope is magical. Perspective allows us to balance both. With this album, my purpose is to lift people up into the clouds while keeping them grounded by what can be the harshness of reality. It's about humanity, hope, and healing. Above the Clouds and On the Ground is available wherever you love to listen to music. You can also visit alexrunyons.com. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
That I was a king without a queen, a son without a moon, a life without a dream. Yeah, that's me without you, a dusk without a dawn.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Armand Nikhil Show on 101.9. On CITR 101.9 FM, mumbled, ate some words there. You were listening to our conversation with Russell Vong, and we're just going to pick up where we left off, talking to Russell about housing in Vancouver.
Yeah. Thanks, Nikhil. So you described sewer upgrades in one of your blog posts as a small tail wagging a very big dog. Yes. Could you just break down, you know, what's going on with these sewer upgrades? What's the dynamic here, and why is it wagging this big dog?
So the example I think of is, you know, thinking of the Expo line, the SkyTrain. You've got Joyce Station. You've got the next one closer to downtown, where you probably have more demand, is 29th Avenue Station. After that, you have Nanaimo Station. You have Broadway Station. And, yeah, near Broadway Commercial Station, Nanaimo, and 29th Avenue, it feels like they're frozen in time since the mid-80s. Like, there's hardly any development that has happened near there, in contrast with Joy Station. So in particular at 29th Avenue in Nanaimo, Francis Beulah looked into it, and the city says, well, we need to upgrade the sewer system. Like, if we want to add more people to this neighborhood, we need to have more sewer capacity. And, you know, that's a reasonable answer, except that the cost of upgrading sewers is way less than the cost of building housing. People just pay a lot more for rent than they do for, you know, water service. Something like, you know, it's like a factor of 10. And so this is another thing where perhaps the federal government can get involved, or maybe the provincial government, is to say, well, look, here's some infrastructure funding so you can upgrade the sewer capacity near 29th Avenue and Nanaimo stations faster than you are currently planning to in this 50-year plan. And that would unlock a lot more housing, like private housing investment. Like, it should then be possible to, like, just build a lot more housing near 29th Avenue Station, near Nanaimo Station. In general, it always seems to me like City of Vancouver is like pushing down on a balloon. Because, again, when you don't build housing, people find somewhere else to live. One response is again, to move down the housing ladder. But another response is, like, people end up moving further out. And so we have this situation where, you know, maybe we'll build a 40-story building near Broadway Station. But if you look at Brentwood Station, Metrotown, they're building 80-story buildings at Lougheed. So instead of people living near Broadway Commercial Station, you know, they're moving out to Burnaby, they're moving out to Surrey. I hear they're building high-rises in Langley, for example. And so this is the kind of issue, the kind of spatial mismatch that results in really terrible traffic congestion. Like, if you push people out to places where they have to drive instead of being on a rapid transit line, they have to drive through your neighborhood and to get to their jobs, you know, because our job centers are going to be more like downtown Vancouver, Broadway area. And so by pushing down on a balloon, you're pushing people further out and you're making everybody like everybody's commute worse off.
Well, what do you think is going on psychologically? Like, why? Like, they probably see the math that you're describing, that, you know, these sewer upgrades aren't that expensive, and, you know, you potentially you could make the case that, you know, you, once you upscale, there's so many more taxpayers. So why don't they see the math the other way? Why are they so, like, fixated on these kind of seemingly small and inconsequential costs?
I think it's just, I think of keeping property taxes low as like the prime directive of municipal politicians. Like, it is extremely, that's the real third rail of municipal politics is, oh, we want you to pay more. And so anytime any kind of cost comes up that you're not already planning for, that's not already in your budget, like, hey, can we do these sewer upgrades faster? The answer is going to be like, oh, like, do we really have to? Same thing with, I don't know, replacing or maintaining community centers. A lot of stuff gets pushed off because it's like, well, we don't think the taxpayers are willing to pay more.
So in your experience, you're a candidate. Do you think that's a real issue that, like, you know, if you ran on a platform of like, we're going to increase, you know, property taxes or, you know, increase your water bills in order to, you know, lower the cost of housing.
Yeah.
Would that, you know, you think that's just like dead on arrival, or would that be something that could actually, you know, win politically?
I'm not entirely sure. I guess I'm thinking, you know, the current city council did raise property taxes. I mean, people definitely didn't like it, but I don't think that's going to be sort of the critical issue. I think, you know, it would be difficult to win an election saying, oh, we want you to pay more property taxes. But yeah, I guess I think if a city council were to raise property
taxes. Once they've won, they raise.
Yeah, as happened, you know, the last couple of rounds of property tax increases, it, you know, I don't think it's necessarily politically fatal.
Well, yeah, no, you run on outcomes, right? And then you levy the inputs once you're you're in office, which as this city council did.
Right. Yeah, we want the city to run better. Like, you know, we do need to pay for public services. We need to pay for, like, you know, capital costs, projects, and so on.
You know, picking up on what you said about people kind of moving out of the downtown core, like not the downtown core, but like the core, which is the city of Vancouver.
Yeah.
So let's call it the beating heart of the metropolitan area.
Yeah.
Historically. What does it say about us as Vancouverites that we're not tuned into probably one of the biggest issues in the city?
Oh, I mean, I think everyone's aware of it. I guess I think that often people agree there's a big problem, but there's a lot of disagreement as to the kind of diagnosis. You know, like in medicine, you've got symptoms, and then you've got like, well, what's actually causing this, and then what should we do as a result? I think obviously we have consensus that there's a huge problem with housing being too expensive, but even just the idea that we have a shortage of housing and that's what's driving up prices and rents, I think we have no consensus there. There's a well-known author, Patrick Condon, who recently wrote a book, Broken City, which makes the argument that high prices are not caused by lack of supply. In other words, we don't have a shortage. No matter how much housing we build, it's not going to bring down prices. So, you know, to me, this makes no sense. And I don't think he talked to any economists when he was writing this book. But, you know, I think a lot of people believe that. I've heard this from a number of politicians.
And so the solution isn't just to say upgrade the transit system, because there is talk about extending the the Millennium or Expo lines to, sorry, is the Expo line to Langley,
yep.
And you know, obviously the idea is that, well, yeah, we'll let them build housing way out there.
I mean, I think it's not necessarily a bad solution, because certainly rapid transit, by expanding rapid transit, you're kind of expanding the radius of land that is available to build housing. But that said, we have land in the city of Vancouver, which is more centrally located, where more people want to live. It's just extremely underused right now. Not so much, you know, the Broadway area has a lot of rental housing already, but if you look south of there, you know, like Shaughnessy. So Christine Boyle with One City brought forward a motion to say, okay, can we add more or make it possible to add more housing in Shaughnessy. And that was shot down. But I think it's something that should be kind of looked at. Shaughnessy is an area that has very few renters, and so if you replace housing there with apartment buildings, you would have very little displacement. You know, you're going to cause less pain and suffering for the renters who have to move and then come back as buildings are replaced.
Absolutely. Just to clarify, by the way, I wasn't taking an anti-Must transit position, saying that I just don't like people from Langley, so I don't know why we have to extend the you know, SkyTrain there.
A typical motorist attitude being displayed here. You know, we were talking about the sewer upgrades. There, you know, there is a, you know, the Bill 15. This whole conversation happening where the provincial government wants to fast track infrastructure projects. You know, before that, they had, I think, as you mentioned, Bill 40 in the last session to incentivize municipalities to rezone, and not even just incentivize. In some ways, there was a bit of a stick that they would basically review their rezoning decisions if they didn't match population growth numbers. Can you give us a bit more? What is your impression of those approaches? And is there a point where you would be concerned of, you know, the provincial or federal government overreaching? Or you're just like, okay, this is a problem, we need to solve it, by whatever means necessary.
I can't speak to Bill 15 because I haven't really looked at it. But in terms of the overall approach that the provincial government has taken in saying, okay, we want you to make approvals faster. We want you to reduce development charges, which the federal government is also talking about. I think those definitely make sense because for municipal governments, one of the key points that the McPhail report made is their incentives are backwards. Because they obtain a fair amount of revenue from taxes on development charges on new housing, they have a direct financial interest in housing continuing to be scarce and expensive. So that is one reason why they would move pretty slowly. It's like if they were to make it easy to suddenly build six-story apartment buildings everywhere, and if housing therefore became cheaper, that would be a financial disaster for them because they are counting on that revenue.
But wouldn't there be more units so they have more to tax?
No. The way that the municipal taxes work, there's this thing called the mill rate.
Yeah.
And the more the value of the property, the more it goes up. Basically, all that happens is the mill rate goes down. So actually adding more value to property by building more housing does not actually help with municipal government's fiscal problem, like how do we pay for all of the services that people need. So yeah, unfortunately, municipal incentives are backwards. Their incentive is to keep things expensive and then to extract as much revenue as they can from giving people permission to build, you know, a six-story apartment building. So we will need intervention from the provincial government and from the federal government to make things happen. And yeah, the provincial government has been very active. There's experience from the states where California has been going through this, like there's state legislative action to push cities and municipalities to allow more housing. And there's this kind of back and forth because the state will say, okay, you need to do this. And individual cities may evade or try to find some way to get around what the state is doing. And then the state has to go back and like pass some new legislation. So there will be this kind of back and forth, I expect, between BC, the provincial government, and the municipalities.
But is there some limit, like from your perspective, is there some limit of like, okay, this is overreach where we, or like, what point does it like, okay, cities don't even need to exist because we're going to just have the provincial government and the federal government, you know, make these determinations, and they can appoint someone to be mayor, but they, you know, it's more of a they follow the instructions of the upper levels of government rather than, you know, being their own voice.
You mean like, are you talking about the province doing something like they did with the Vancouver School Board a couple times?
Yeah,
like
just
appointing a new board.
Yeah, yeah, like they fire the whole city council, appoint their own. Like, is there some limit of you? Like, okay, this is not. Except, like, I want the city to actually exist and be its own elected thing, or
So that's a good question. There's this principle of, I think it's called subsidiarity, which has to do with where decisions are made. And yeah. You want them to be made, you know, basically if it's appropriate at sort of the lowest possible level. But the record that we have of like housing being like really scarce and expensive in the city of Vancouver to me really demonstrates that the current decision-making process, which is not just city level, but sort of very hyper-local through this public hearing process of individual approval on a site-by-site basis for every project. Again, you know, the people who show up to weigh in on these decisions are going to be the people who are right in the area. You're not even going to get people across the city. So yeah, I would argue that the current decision-making process is too local, it's too low level, and it should be elevated. So one of the recommendations from the McPhail report was really municipal governments should be focusing more on kind of broad processes, like make high-level decisions that affect across the entire city, not, okay, we're going to make a decision on this one particular project, and it's going to involve 1 year of public consultation and negotiation before anything gets approved and anything can be built.
So like the Broadway plan was like is that what you're describing? Like how they approved a whole like regional block of approvals in one shot?
Well, not really. Yeah. I would say that because the Broadway plan was a policy that affects a wide area. Yeah. So that part of it seems reasonable. I mean, people disagree about the specifics of, you know, that we're putting all of this development. We're saying, okay, you can't build anywhere else in the city. You can only build in this area that already has a lot of renters in it. Yeah. People can agree or disagree about the specifics of that. But the thing is, the Broadway plan did not actually change the laws. It's just like a statement, a policy, guidance to the planners who then still have to change the laws for each and every project.
I see. So they still have to go through approval like one by one. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. It's a very slow, labor-intensive, therefore expensive process. And yeah, this is why we have this kind of crazy situation where we have land is very scarce, but also very underused. It's like so difficult to change the use of any piece of land because it has to be done one at a time.
I have a bit of a spiritual question, I guess, spiritual in the political sense, and kind of more like abstract, where, you know, we were talking about, I think a couple of years ago when there was a plan, part of the Broadway plan, they were talking about view cones, right? And they said, these are corridors in the city, we want to protect views. And people say that, yeah, well, Vancouver's city has beautiful views, and if you build everywhere, then that goes away. Like, it's not really the Vancouver I know. So what do you say to this idea that Vancouver is this static idea of Vancouver as being having a certain set of views that we need to protect in order for it to be the city that we know and love and live in and work in? And
I guess I would say I spend a lot of time on Reddit, so I use the Vancouver Reddit as a kind of sounding board. So yeah, I guess I would say people on the Vancouver Reddit are, to me, you know, somewhat surprisingly, they do value the views that Vancouver has. They see it as a public amenity, like having parks. But I guess I would describe it as you want to do kind of a cost benefit. You want to weigh the costs and the benefits. And so you probably want to look at the specifics of the individual view cones, because the view cones correspond to individual, I think it's laws. I'm not sure if it's laws or policies, but there's like quite a lot of them. And so there was a recent review to say, okay, well, what is the cost of having a particular view cone and what is the benefit? Is this something that actually does provide a stunning view of the city that a lot of people can enjoy? Or is it something that you kind of see as you're driving over a particular bridge? And in terms of cost, like how much does it constrain what you can build in some of the most expensive land in the city? So I do feel like you probably want to go through a more like scientific, data-driven process of saying, well, how much is this costing us? And what is the benefit in terms of, like, you know, is this something people are willing to take that cost to have this view?
So we're coming to the end of our show. I have a kind of more silly question to wrap things up. And I'll just, it's about some, you know, Twitter beef in BC politics. But it is housing related in some sense. Wyatt Claypool, who is a staffer for one of the independent MPs that recently left the Conservative Party, he recently got into a Twitter fight with BC Conservative House Leader Warbus. And he was explaining that, you know, he is, you know, sacrificing a lot to have the...
I'm just going to pull it up for you.
Yeah, there's no internet for some reason here. But he was explaining basically why he was unable, why he's, you know, sacrificing so much by working for this independent NP. I think he's earning $25,000 per month. Per year.
It perked up for a little. You're like, is that the new urban poor?
Yeah. And then House Leader Warbus decided to weigh in.
I'm just pulling it up. Hold up. Wow, this person tweets a lot. Well, basically, so...
Do you pull up here? Or you can't?
Elon changed everything up, so you gotta... Oh, I have it here. So, yeah. So, Well, yeah, Warbus said, his mom doesn't charge him rent, that's why.
He was saying that he sacrificed so much for $25,000, and she was saying... So I was just wondering, do you think it's appropriate to shame grown men for living with their mothers in this economy that we are struggling with, for the House Leader to engage in such tactics?
I would say, you know, certainly I don't think that people should feel ashamed for you know, having to live with their parents. That's not something I would certainly shame someone for. As to whether it's appropriate, I mean, honestly, not having looked at this particular Twitter beef, but being someone who, like a lot of people, enjoys conflict, I always enjoy these kind of dramas. I can't actually say... the specifics of this argument and back and forth, and whether that was a low blow or just part of the process.
We'll have to leave it there. So that was the CPBC House Leader. Thank you so much for being on the show, Russell. Any closing thoughts?
I should just say that if people are interested in this, I would really recommend anyone who's interested in housing in Vancouver and BC, really, I would really recommend that they read the MacPhail report. It's, you know, fairly detailed, but not too involved. And I try to post daily on morehousing.ca. There's always lots of things happening. The good thing is governments are now fully engaged with the problem. Like, people recognize that this is a problem, and yeah, they're highly motivated to try to fix it, because younger people especially are super mad.
That's a good point to leave to end at. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Armonic Hill on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. The music for the show is composed with the inexorable musical talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed. Also, congratulations on your upcoming wedding, Sarah. We do have some awesome shows with a set of guests, amazing guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feed, so do check them out there.
Thank you, and good night.